to hear a little bit more from Matthew Santosh Thomas. And here's, I'm assuming most of you just came from one, unless you skipped to take a nap or something like that. I think the format will be generally the same. We'll give Santosh about the first 45 minutes or so to tell you a little bit more about specifically the epidemic in India and some of its causes and some of the responses. And we'll leave the last 15 minutes for some dialogue, so some question and answer in return. How many of you have ever read Lord of the Flies? This is the conch. Okay? You must use this before you can ask your question. So just know when that time comes, I'm going to hand this to you and you must speak into it. Okay? And the reason why is that this particular session will be the one that ends up posted to the website for others to be able to listen to if they haven't had a chance to come listen to Santosh during this time. So we want to make sure, you probably listened to a recording at some time in your life when you couldn't hear the question and it's totally infuriating to you. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had that happen?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So we'll hand this to you when you have a chance to ask that question. So how you feeling? You doing okay? All right, let's welcome up Santosh. I'll pray for him, and then we'll get started. Come on. Lord, I thank you so much for this brother. I thank you for his really incredible work, his heart that is pursuing you and pursuing the gospel. Pray, Lord, that you would prepare our hearts to hear from him and to receive him and to respond with faith and with joy to the things that we'll be discovering today. Lord, we thank you in Christ's name.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you. Good evening, and what I would do over the next 45 minutes is to kind of give an overview of some of those issues which contribute to the HIV scenery in the country, in India, and how those becomes opportunities to bring in the heart of God into the situation. India is a huge country, 1.9 billion population, 20 different countries in one country, 20 different cultures. So it's difficult to kind of capture what happens in the country. And you don't know what's happening in the country most of the time because it's multiple countries. But my presentation mostly will be looking at the northern part of the country where we are involved. India has got 1.9 billion population, of which only 2.5 or 2.8% are Christians, and of which 90% are in the south or the northeast. The northern part is where the Christian presence is less than 1%, where health indices are very low, where development indices are very low, and that is where we as a chain of Christian hospitals work. But that's also where HIV prevalence is on the lower side. But still, there are factors which are contributing. So I'll try to bring in a few perceptions from that. Just giving an overview of what I'm going to talk is, again, it is not comprehensive, it is just a snapshot into some of those issues, because being a huge country with multiple factors, I won't be able to bring in all, but some of those snapshots on. So I'll give you an overview of what India is, the context of India, the HIV context, some of three main factors which are contributing or which becomes contributory and opportunities. Like Stella said yesterday, an opportunity. How does this factor become an opportunity? We'll look at three major factors and then summarize it. Many of you know about India because India is up in the media a lot. We are taking over the globe economically. That's what is being highlighted, that we are world leader in IT and et cetera, et cetera. All this we see. These are quotes from major international newspapers. But the fact is, we are very confident in what we are, but it is not the majority. It's a tiny light, a tiny percentage of which is holding this. For example, India has 23 billionaires. We've got 25 plus huge industries, but they're owned by families. It is not a public sector undertaking. Yes, they are out in the stock market, but 55% or 51% would be owned by the family. It would be the Tatas and the Ambanis and the Reliance and the Mittal. You probably know about Mittal, who's in US. Family-owned businesses. But those are the groups which are adding. I'm putting some pictures which might be more related to the British context. If you look at this picture, I don't know how many of you know. I suppose you know this. It's not baseball. It's the equivalent of baseball in India, which is cricket, not hockey, cricket. Bollywood. In England there was this Big Brother show, and she won the show. So globally, you know, Bollywood, cricket, the IT industries in South India. This is the German steel industry taken over by Mittal from India. So this is the kind of thing which are highlighted. But on the other hand, what we call as the invisible India, which is not generally highlighted, where in the context of the globalization, where the country deregulates its market, there is more than 30%, which is earning less than 1%, $1 a day. A non-functional public healthcare system in the rural North India. Low education, primarily the rural in North India. And the fast increasing urban poor. Just to highlight some of those things, with all this improvement, we are still 127 in the Human Development Index in the world. And a disappointing and a distressing factor has been that with all the globalization happening, the IT boom is happening, the health tourism is happening, but the basic industry was agriculture. That's not getting support. So farmers have committing suicide. We still have malnourishment. And of the 400 million workforce, only about 2 million are in the new economy, which is the IT and the health industry. I was just telling the last workshop group a story. About a couple of months back, I went to one of the tertiary level hospitals in Delhi. And I sat sitting with the CEO, one of those top hospitals. We don't have health insurance. Less than 2% have insurance in the country. That is only the well-off. So this hospital, I walked in and was talking to the CEO, and they said, "Doctor, 50% of our clientele comes from UK and Europe. It's a cardiac center where interventional cardiology surgeries are done. Less than 1% of the population which requires intervention for cardiac diseases get access in the country. But here is a hospital in Delhi which caters 50 to 60% of its clientele comes in from Britain and Europe because it's cheaper to fly into India and get." So that's the kind of paradox in which our country is developing. It's in that background you need to look at HIV. We're supposed to have 5.7 million population people living with HIV, which is the biggest in the world. Though, remember, it is 5.7 million out of 1.9 billion, which is only less than 0.9 or 0.9%. But in the last year or so, there has been a re-looking at the numbers, and government is saying it is only 2.5 million and our prevalence is less than 0.5%. Many of us who are practitioners, we are saying we don't know whether it is right or not. Because a country is so huge, the capturing of data is not robust, and they are extrapolated based on available data. And one thing we are sure, though there has been reports that we might be the next wave country, the epicenter, we have not followed the African epidemic. In 85 or 84, when Africa became, sub-Saharan Africa infection started, within 20 years, the prevalence went up to 5, 8, 20, 30, up to some countries up to 30, some 25, some 8. We also started in 86, but over 20 years, we have only 0.9%. prevalence. We are not seeing it because we work in rural North India in our hospitals. We don't see patients coming in large numbers, whereas in Delhi, in a city, we see large numbers. Northeast of the country, which is again, I'll come to that later, mostly in the borders, we see large numbers. But in the big bulk of the country, we don't see large numbers, which also brings the question, why is it? If the predictions are right, we should have followed the African epidemic pattern, but we haven't. Even with all this, we contribute almost 75% of the burden in the region. Just to give a broad overview of how the infection happens, 86% is through heterosexual contact. It is not through drug use or gay, homosexual relationships. It is heterosexual contact, 85%. There is a 2 to 3% from sharing of needles. Again, primarily in the northeastern part of the country. How many of you are aware of Golden Triangle? Golden Triangle is the Cambodia, the Thailand, that region where there is drug trafficking. From that part of the country, from the globe, drugs pass through the northeastern part of the state country into southern China. So these states are in the route. So there is a large amount of drug use there and sharing of needles. And surprisingly, the three out of three states where this is highly prevalent are Christian states. We have only three Christian states in the country, two primarily, and all these are highly infected with HIV. There's high prevalence. It's a question which we, as a small percentage of Christians in the country, have been asking, why is it that Christian states have the large number of drug use? I'll come to that later. There is about 2% from blood transfusion and an increasing number of mother-to-child transmission, because the primary transmission is through two groups, that is the migrant laborers and the trucking industry. Men in villages who don't have access to employment, in the culture, there has been, on one hand, an acceptance of practices, on the other hand, a strong, so there is a paradox in our country. So I talked about hijras in the plenary, the castrated males in female, these are the pictures. They are accepted as a part of the religious culture group. A couple of years back, one of our senior doctors did a study with the Hindu religious leaders and asked this question, why do people fall sick? The answer was that, this is the answer. So what comes out of this kind of studies is that we have a culture which is very subjective. What do you mean by that? There is no absolute value. Standards are changing. There are no shared standards. Kings and leaders are above standards, because kings used to rule, or if a leader says, that is the final. And the tradition is oral. Contrast that with the Judeo-Christian culture. You find absolute values, widely shared standards, and we will hold kings and leaders against a value system. They cannot change the value system, but we have documented tradition, and our Bible is rooted in history. So this is the paradox of the country, where you have a subjective culture, and this creates an excellent opportunity. In the context of a culture where there is no absolute values, where actually there is on one hand strong family ties, I talk about importance of family ties, but the paradox of accepted temple sexual practices, it's gives an excellent opportunity to bring in a value into a community, into youth. We did a study recently, I think last year, we did a study at six different sites from rural adolescents, girls and boys. And we were looking at the unsafe sexual practices. And we found that every village, even in the interior rural village, had access to pornographic videos, because IT boom, the information technology boom has opened up the televisions into the any village you go. DVD players are kept in villages, youth sit and watch, of course pirated, not original. That kind of openness, opening is creating high risk behaviors. The question was, how do you, is it a risk? Yes, it is a risk, but it is also an opportunity to bring a value into the community. We started off talking to girls and teaching them about, you know, don't get married. They get married in 14 or 15 years of age. They are married off because it is arranged marriages. I have offered this, those who want classes on arranged marriage, I'll take later. It works well. Large families, diseases, dowry, where, how many of you know about dowry? Dowry is where the girl's family pays a certain amount of money into the boy's family. So we started talking about that. But the question was, would it really change behavior? Because these girls have no status. I'm coming to that later. When they get married, they have no, they are not sure about their values. So it's very important. Soon we realized, if you really want to protect a generation at risk, it is not STDs or HIV. It's a value system which have to be brought in. In the context of a relative culture, subjective culture, you need to bring in an absolute value by creating training modules on which bring in a value. For example, Genesis says, in Genesis, what does the marriage say? Why is, what is marriage for? What is the verse which talks about marriage? Yeah, what is the verse? What does the verse say? A woman shall leave. Sure? A man shall leave his father and mother and they become one flesh. Is it for procreation only? It is for procreation and a stewardship of the resources in the world and rule over the world. But even that concept of a man shall leave, here in our culture, a woman shall leave and serve the man for procreation of the family. Now into that we are bringing in a one flesh. You are one flesh, not for procreation alone. You are one flesh in Christ, in God, as a unit. Whereas here, it is a totally different. So it's a very important opportunity, an excellent opportunity to bring in a different value system in the context of a subjective culture. Now, I'm leaving that and going into the next area of marginalization. I'm only giving snippets of certain social cultural factors. One of the major issues is the gender marginalization. I talked in the plenary also about this. In the culture, in the Hindu culture, women are seen as second-class citizens, where women do not have a value. There is no bargaining power for issues, either for economic or for sex. And contributory factor is low literacy. For example, in rural North India, only 25 to 28% of women are literate, whereas about 60% of men are literate. In the country, about 65% of men are literate, whereas about 40 to 45% of women are literate. So there is a low literacy among women itself. And this creates a major risk for HIV. Yesterday, Pax was talking about, no, I think it was somebody else was talking about 80% of the, Ihab was talking about 80% of the women are infected from their single partners. For us, 90% of the women are infected by their husbands. And they are faithful spouses but becoming widows. They are seen as a culprit and a burden. And many times when the husband is brought for treatment, they would have spent 300,000 to 400,000 rupees on the husband's treatment. They would have sold off everything because he is the breadwinner. And when the woman comes for treatment, there won't be anything. And what happens is that the inheritance issues will become an issue. Now, if the husband dies, to whom should the land and the house go? Yeah, it's a joint family. It is not a nuclear family. You live with your father-in-law and the mother-in-law and the brother-in-law and the sister-in-law and the thing where the inheritance has to be kept with the family. So many times the widows are marginalized, blackmailed, with the added burden of caring for this thing. And many of the patients who come to us for treatment are widows like this, who have entered up in this thing. And the question is, it is a risk, but it is also an opportunity. It's an opportunity to bring, educate women and bring a different value that I'll come to that little later. So the second marginalization is the caste. The story goes that there are four castes. The highermost caste is born out of the brain. They are the thinkers, the intellectuals who hold the finance. The second level of caste are born out of the biceps. They are the warriors. The third are born out of the belly. They are the traders, the, you know. And the lowermost caste is born out of the foot. This is the story in the Hindu mythology, that born out of the foot, because they are the menial, and they are born into it. They are not put into it, they are born into it. So this caste system leads to inequality of opportunities. For example, the land is owned by the brain and the kshatriyas, the warriors. So the lower caste only are employees in the field. They don't have access to land. They don't have access to education and even for health. So that becomes a major contributor to the epidemic, because like I said, 60% of, 80% of the time they are in cities in search of jobs, and they get infected, they pass it on. The many of the families who come to us in Delhi are families like this. This is a widow, young widow and two children. Husband ended up in Delhi, came for job, got infected, passed it on to the wife and one of the children, he passed on, and now she is left with two children in Delhi, in the slums, looking for a job. Again, this is husband and wife, both infected. Again, came to an urban context because of lack of opportunity in the village. So poverty itself is a big marginalization in the country. This picture is depicting four different aspects of poverty. This is 50% of the world's malnourished children are in the country. And those that man is a farmer, one of the farmers who committed suicide. I was talking about this is a group which migrated out of Gujarat after the earthquake. We were there as a team after the, you have heard about the earthquake which happened in 2001, a major earthquake. And I was there 48 hours later with a team. And as we moved into villages after villages, we found the high caste would get all the supportive services. But the low caste have no support. They finally had to migrate out. And this where they were was a family migrating into Bombay. So that kind of marginalization due to caste and poverty happens. The last and not the least is the upcoming stigmatized behaviors. And I want to focus on one, that is the drug use. Especially in the context of cities like Delhi, Mumbai, and major upcoming cities, the poor are coming in with no access for opportunities. Youth are getting into drugs. And in the context of poverty, you have end up helping each other to inject, share needles. But the more alarming is what I said in the morning, just before, that there are three northeastern states which are Christian, but large number of drug users and high prevalence of HIV. You want to look at these pictures and spend some time on these pictures. this happens in one Christian state from where these pictures were taken. This is not 10-year-old, this is about 2-year-old. If a drug user is found, they are chained to the together to de-addict. The stigma on of drug use is so much that either they are tonsured off, hair is cut off and paraded, or they are put into cages like this so that they can be kicked out of the habit. Perpetuated by Christian community. So behaviors are stigmatized. And one of our major work is among this group to get the church mobilized to accept marginalized behaviors as part of the community and create entry points into their lives. So it's in that context, harm reduction, you know, should we have harm reduction, needle exchange, condoms, you know, all those have to be brought in. So I talked about four kinds of marginalization. One is the gender, the caste, the poverty, and behaviors, right? Drug use and sex work. Each of those creates an excellent opportunity to bring the heart of God. For example, when there is gender inequality, I mean, what does the Bible say? Equal in creation and equal in redemption. There is no difference between man and woman. But it is totally different paradigm for a culture, a Hindu or an Indian culture. And that becomes an excellent opportunity to empower women. For example, many of these widows, which I showed about this picture, are now transformed their lives, found Christ, and are taking up jobs. This is the same lady who came in with the meningitis today, 3 years down the line, when she was on antiretroviral treatment, getting already on a job, worshipping in a church, a Hindu. It becomes an opportunity. Similarly, for the low caste who is born into a caste, not out of choice, but by birth, empowering through self-help groups, micro-enterprises, and programs becomes an opportunity to, you know, bring in a heart of God who says there is no Jew, no Gentile, no white, no black, no yellow, no green, whatever it is, they're all equal in the sight of God. It brings an opportunity to show a heart. Similarly, these are some of the drug addicts, drug users who have come to know the Lord and are leading a worship in one of our programs. Marginalized behaviors become an entry point for transformation. The last I want to look at is caring culture. Yes, time is up.
Yeah,
15
minutes to go.
Yeah, okay. Right on time. In the Indian religion, whether it's Jain or Hindu, there is no concept of care in the Eastern religion because body is not valuable. Now, there's something called karma and rebirth. You live, you earn your merits. Depending on the merits you earn, you are born as a higher creature or a lower creature. If you do well, you might end up as a better human being in a higher level. If you do poorly, you might end up as an animal in the next birth. It's a cycle of birth and rebirth, dependent on your karma. And especially in the context of that, even our medical education, there's a lot of emphasis on cure, not on care. So life is assessed by the value you bring in terms of money. How much money you bring in? It is not the same. I talked about that young boy, Rohit. In the plenary, I talked about a boy who's infected, whose father would abuse. This is that boy. The question for us was, how long will this smile last? He doesn't bring any value. He's infected. He would die. There's no value for his life because he's not going to bring in a revenue into the family. The same study which I told earlier, we also interviewed some of the Hindu leaders and asked, what about caring in the culture? They said, no, if I am busy with worshipping God, that is my karma. If I leave, my God will be angry. So there is, in the culture, a lack of caring. And whereas, in the Judeo-Christian culture is where you you see a person as a whole, where the body has a dignity, whether it is diseased or sick or okay, because inherently the body needs to be respected. And that creates an excellent opportunity to bring in a culture of caring and show the love of Christ, the heart of God. And that opens up opportunities for life transformation. So we looked at three things, three of the many factors which contribute. One is a culture which is subjective, where you can actually bring in an absolute values. A marginalization due to various factors, of which four I highlighted, that is the gender, the caste, the poverty, the behaviors, where again is an opportunity to bring a heart of God which is for the poor and the marginalized. A lack of caring culture, where is an opportunity to redeem the culture of caring and bring, share the heart of God, which is a heart of compassion and caring. I leave this here because this I have emphasized in the last plenary. I believe more than that, it's our transformation which happens. And possibly with mothers and children like this can be prevented if the Indian church recaptures the values, the heart of God for the marginalized, and the culture of caring. But the question for us is, we have 1.9 billion population and Christian presence is much small. It needs a lot of effort and prayer. So this is just an overview, so I leave it open for questions.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. I have a question about the, you said that you're not seeing either in the or in the hospital clinics the latent edge of the next wave, but even though there's a suspicion that there is a next wave, where do you think that latent population might be?
Yeah, I think what's happening is, in our country, there are six states where the high prevalence is. The four southern states and the two northeastern states. But majority of the population is in the central, north and central India. And we are finding large numbers in the southern states and northeast states. It was anticipated that the North India, where there's large number of migrant population, would be the next wave. Because, I mean, they're all migrants, they have villages, illiteracy, and people are traveling all over, they should be. But surprisingly, over 20 years, we are finding hot spots across various places, but not large numbers in rural areas. We in Delhi see large numbers. Our programs in Northeast see large numbers. Our programs in certain hospital locations in certain hot pockets see large numbers. But when you walk into a general community, we are not seeing. So the government and many people who are involved in predicting numbers are saying we are probably on the downward trend. Many of us are not very sure. So I can't answer that question, actually. One of the things we feel is that because we are a plural culture, multiple cultures, there's less crossover. For example, in the African context, correct me if I'm wrong, it might be one or two or three major people groups. Here we have 20, 25 people groups. The tribals don't have contact, sexual contact. I'm talking about high-risk contacts with the scheduled caste. The lower caste will never have the higher caste. So it's possible that because we are multiple cultures in the same state, we are protected. So nobody in India has an answer. People are waiting to see how it will evolve. But the fact is, over 20 years, we haven't evolved the way sub-Saharan Africa or Western Africa evolved. That is true. Our numbers are large because our population is large. Our percentage prevalence is still not high.
I wonder if I might ask a follow-up question about that. You mentioned that the Christian provinces seem to have the highest degree of incidence. Could you talk a little bit about why you think that might be?
That's a question we ourselves are asking. I think there are multiple factors. One, northeastern part of the country is a secluded part of the country where high level of education, actually it is, don't take me wrong, it's the American missionaries who moved into northeast country, Nagaland and two or three states, and established a large number of schools and colleges, excellent education. But it was not followed up by the government putting in infrastructure for employment. So here is a youth which is highly educated. The American missionary movement in early 19th centuries to early 20th centuries, highly educated youth, but no opportunities for employment. Two, it is border states. There is always conflicts in the border. Wherever there is conflict, there is military. Wherever there is military, there is sex work. Wherever there is sex work, there is drug use. And politically, it is kept alive because it is border to Burma, Myanmar, China. Three, the Golden Triangle. So I don't think it is the Christian state, Christianity alone, but multiple other factors. But it's in the context of a Christian state.
Another question.
You mentioned that your organization educates young girls against the evils of early marriage. And I'm wondering how that is useful when their marriages are arranged.
Yeah.
And wondering if they get any say in when they get married. And
It's a difficult, I mean, we ask this question ourselves and we are finding that it is not, there's no point in training the girls alone. You need to have girls and boys trained together. But the problem is the young men are out migrating for work. You go to villages, those whom you get to talk to are the girls. The boys are not there. So it's an extremely difficult issue to get both boys and girls together. So I said girls, we also are trying with boys. And we also realized unless you do education with the families, that is the father and the mother, who are actually the decision makers, things can't change. But in a context of a large community, we can only do a little bit with the hope that the little we put in will bring in a value system which would probably prevent the next generation. It's protecting a generation at risk, probably the next generation. It's also an opportunity to bring in a value system which is a totally new paradigm for this thing. I don't have an answer. It is an issue which our own programs are asking, what's the point when the decisions are not in their hands? But if out of 100, 10 girls are empowered to stand and say, no, I will not get married till I'm 21, it's still worth it.
Thank you. You commented how certain Christian communities have no compassion for those who are caught in drug use and these behaviors. Has there been, or do you know if there's any plans for Christian leaders who understand the compassion of Jesus to begin to try to educate and influence those communities?
Yeah. It's not a question of having no compassion. It's a question of the stigma associated with drug use. I mean, over years, drug use is seen as sin. So anything which is sinful should be punished. Most of our work among drug users are in those two states in the Northeast, which are small states, which is amenable to work with a small group. And a lot of our work is with churches, trying to create an environment where to say that, okay, this is part of the problem. It's a part of the community. This is a problem in the church. Let's accept it. And then create opportunities to enter into their lives. And it's not only with church, it's also with the military. Because the drug use is illegal. So if you find a drug user, the military will shoot or put him in a jail. So you need to advocate with the military and the paramilitary forces to say that, like Ihab was saying in the morning, in the session, advocate with them saying that, no, punishing or putting in jail does not take care of the problem. People move into oblivion, into go underground, continue the habit, more members join the group, more needle sharing happens. Our programs cater to about 16,000 drug users with safe needles. And many of these groups that are doing it are church-based NGOs, voluntary organizations. So we are helping church-based NGOs to do it, hoping that, you know, church, the hierarchy of the church will understand it.
Kind of an offbeat question, but why do you think the Western world has been so enamored with the Indian culture and karma and all of that? I mean, I'm looking at what you've talked about, the culture that seem the care for the body. What is it that attracts us?
Interesting. I think you should be telling me. I'll probably but I'll try to kind of, I'll try to answer that. I mean, for me, for us as a Christian community, a small, you know, the minority community in India, we always wonder why. I mean, here we are as a minority community trying to talk about absolute values, and here the supposedly Christian culture and group coming to India for a subjective culture. I think it is because you are moved from objective to subjective here. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No.
I might be. You have objective roots. You have absolute roots. But you're moved away. The roots are there. But what is around you is not objective. And people are looking for answers. And India, our culture has been there for 3,000 years, 4,000 years, much before Christianity came in. That's what. And it is very relative. You can have 300,000 gods, and you can have Christ also. 300,001 makes no difference. As long as you say that Jesus is one of the 300,000 plus. The moment you say Jesus is the only answer, there's a problem. If you don't say that, our culture is a very, accepting culture. Till you say that you are this is the only way. And that's what the West is looking for, because the so-called objective culture, which had influence on the families and the values, have gone away. And instead of going back to the roots, the people are looking for alternatives. And here is one which will accept anybody who walks in. This is my perception, I might be wrong.
So one of my questions was asked already, so thanks for answering that one. One question I had remaining was, in terms of the folks who are using IV drugs, is that a particular caste that's sort of tending to be at higher risk, or is that mostly coming from the part of the country where that system is not so much in place because of the...
There are two groups primarily. One is the Northeastern, what I said, the Northeast states, where the educated youth, which is not any caste, this thing. The other is if you look at one picture, sitting and needling, they are the migrant laborers who come into Delhi, very poor people, who have no other options for release, and they end up into drug peddling and drugging. So there are two groups like that.
And that also, it seems like from your photos and from what you've been describing, it's mostly men, that it's not, that
it's
women do not.
It's mostly men,
to be.
And there is, in Northeast, there is a percentage of women who are drug users and into sex trade, but very small percentage.
And then my last question was, are there no religious leaders in any of the other faiths who are sort of embracing in a more accepting view of people who have, who are HIV positive?
Generally not. The Muslim community is very, almost 15% of our population is Muslim. They haven't taken any action. Hindu groups, some Hindu itself has mission work, Ramakrishna Mission, various mission programs are there. So some of them are talking about values, talking about the ABC, abstinence, be faithful. You know, they're trying to bring in all those. There is some talk. But comes to caring, it is not there. Because, for example, one interesting issue is that you don't have any palliative care center in the country. In a huge country like that, we have, I think, only 3 or 4 palliative care centers are there, which are all run by Christians or some non-Christian organizations. There is no concept of palliative care. For example, geriatric care. Most of the geriatric care or old age homes are in South Kerala, which is about 30% Christian. Whereas you come to North, there is no old age homes. Again, that is also because we have strong family ties. That's all the other side of it. So there is no culture of wanting to care for the elderly, the marginalized.
Hello, thank you very much for what you've shared. I'm wondering about you, what your work is. And from the little bio, I don't know. Are you part of a hospital? Do you have private care? Do you work in the streets? I would like to know more about you.
I don't, as of now, I don't do anything, actually. we are a part of, for those who want to know more about what EHA is, there are some annual reports and brochures there. We are a part of 20 rural Christian mission hospitals. Back in 1960s, there were more than 100, almost 1,000 Christian rural mission hospitals in rural India. And in late 50s, early 60s or mid 60s, most of them were manned by expatriate missionaries, Christian doctors from US or UK or the Europe. And overnight, or over a period of few months, it closed down because of certain changes in the law. And a group of Christian doctors came together to keep those hospitals in North India, that is a rural North India where health indices are poor and Christian presence is low, to resuscitate that, to keep it going. That is how our organization was formed, Emmanuel Hospital Association. We have 20 hospitals, 28 community health programs, 8 HIV programs. Me and Sarah, my wife, both are doctors. We worked in 4 of these hospitals over the last 12 years. The last few years, we moved into HIV AIDS care because that became a major issue. Last 3 months, I have taken over as executive director. That's why I said, now I don't do anything. The boss does not do anything. So only gets others to do things. So I moved on to moving more of administration. But our work takes us into hospitals, slums, drug users, sex workers, community health, HIV AIDS, nursing schools, the whole gamut of this thing, and church planting and evangelism.
An earlier speaker spoke about what she had to do to keep her spirit up, and the picture you're painting is somewhat grim. And so wondering a little bit more, again, on the personal side of how it is that you see, what keeps you going, what gives you hope as you're doing your work.
Somebody else asked the question. I told that person to come back after the session to talk one-to-one, but she was a physician, so she wanted to talk. I think it's an issue of calling. I mean, the only thing which keeps us going in Christian ministry is the clarity of call. I don't think if you look at outcomes or outputs, especially in the context of a Christian mission, you'll ever find that will never drive you. I mean, there will be always discouragements. I think the clarity of call that this is what you're called to do at this point of time in history is what keeps us going. We also have, we're fortunate to have a large number of Christian Indian doctors. For example, in our organization, we have about 120 doctors and about 600 nurses, of which all majority are cross-cultural Indian missionaries. India is a mission-sending country, and we have Indian cross-cultural missionaries who are working and in context across India in various different cultures. So we have our own internal support systems which support each other. Does that answer your... Yes.
So another question I had. So I'm currently in medical school, and I'm interested in looking at the things that all of my seniors do, that my attendings are doing, the values that they sort of, what they value the most has a strong impression on me. And I'm wondering if there's a role for medical students there. Do they come to those hospitals and clinics? Are they working there? Are they learning
definitely
how to care for those patients?
Yeah, definitely. We are open to any point of time. I think we have every year about 40 to 50 elective students coming into our hospitals. We have actually long-term volunteers, doctors, nurses, IT professionals, any profession you want working alongside us, but a small number. I think any given point of time out of our 600 or 700 professional staff, about 20 would be expats who come in and work alongside us. So that opportunity is there. Short term, you can come and see there are opportunities available. And it is an excellent opportunity to see a different paradigm, a different way of practicing medicine, different way of missions, and also be exposed to what God is doing in a different part of the globe.
I actually don't have a question, but it's more of a comment. I was really struck by what you said earlier in the session about how do we see through God's eyes. Mm. And I just hear about how you're able to really see the culture, your culture, and yet reinterpret that through God's eyes. And so I'm just really encouraged. So thank you.
I'm just curious, I don't understand the caste system. I mean, I understand that there are levels, and that a lot of the lowest caste don't get any service at all. I mean, is that relative to what you do or you're able to do? Or people, can anybody come to you?
Yeah, I think it's not that they don't get any access at all, but there's a lot of marginalization due to, for example, if there's a village school, the village school would be kind of promoted by the high caste, and the low caste would be kind of the last to get opportunity to get into the school. Similarly, if they approach for any service, they would be the last to get that service. So a lot of our work is in developing those communities. We have community development programs where we get people together to health education, literacy, micro-enterprises, trying to develop them, empower them. But let me portray another picture. Because of this, there is also an unrest, and you are finding the lower caste much more politically active. There are political parties formed by the low caste. Two states are now run by low caste people in political parties. So there is a activism among them because of years of caste system. This is also creating an opportunity for the gospel, because the low caste in Hindu religion are saying that you have kept us as lower human beings. We want to move out. Large numbers are moving out into Buddhism. There is also a group moving open for the gospel. So there is the other side also of the caste system happening.
You've mentioned the Christian states.
Yep.
Is the caste system active in the Christian states?
No. These states are primarily tribal, but they don't have a caste system, but they have a tribal system where between tribes there are problems. One of the sad things in the country has been, though Christianity, the state where I am from, Kerala, Thomas the Apostle came in AD 52. That's what we believe. There is evidence of church from AD 50 onwards in Kerala, much before the church reached the West or any other part of the world. And we can trace our roots back to AD 52. Northeast, 200, 300 years of Christianity. But one of the things have been that some of the issues which we are grappling with is that the cultural aspects of the context, whether it be tribal culture or the Hindu culture, are still there in the Christian church. Somehow in the gospel has not released people from their cultural or the tribal barriers. But there's the other growing church also where it is different. So there is both.
And I think that's we're going to call that a wrap. It's 5 o'clock, and our speakers have had a long and engaging day of conversations and need a little rest and a dinner time before they head on to the next thing. I'm sure many of you have a little rumbly in your tumbly too. So can we all thank Santosh for his time? Shocking to rediscover that, Lord, as it is lived out in courage and in faith by those who are doing really important work around the world and even here in Berkeley. Lord, we thank you for the blessing that a conference like this can be. We especially thank you for Santosh right now. We thank you for what is obviously a servant's heart, one that is tuned to you and to your work. We pray, Lord, that you would strengthen him for his ongoing work, that you would give him wisdom and creativity, and that you would allow his work to prosper and